Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are broadcasting to the world in association with AllFootballShirts.com. Well, we signed off for the World Cup break with a defeat at the hands of the gravity-defying Aston Villa on Sunday in a game that saw yet more psychedelic refereeing, which makes you wonder, what is the actual point of VAR? So now we have a break in league action until Boxing Day, and as the likes of Trossard and McAllister pack for Qatar, we can sit back and reflect on what has been quite a mad first part of the season, both on and off the pitch, and sees us sitting seventh in the table, a point behind Liverpool and ahead of Chelsea. So, who better to join myself and Alan Wares today than Albion Deputy Chairman Paul Barber? Welcome back to the pool. Welcome back to the show, Paul. We're going swimming.
Thanks, AD and Al. Nice to be back. Thank you.
Good to see you. We were actually recording this on a Wednesday morning. AD, I don't think, has ever seen a Wednesday morning. It's a bizarre time for me. I've been normally been making my coffee at this hour before sitting down to my freelance work. But thanks very much indeed for coming on, Paul. Let me start, if I may. It's been quite a traumatic season so far. We're in seventh place and it's still been traumatic. How's it been for you?
It's been busy. I wouldn't say traumatic, to be honest. I mean, we have to prepare for the sort of changes that we've had, and we do. Doesn't mean to say that, you know, every single position in the club has an immediate replacement lined up. But what it does mean is that we look very closely at these sort of things in terms of succession planning. And we identify where our most important people are, perhaps the most vulnerable to being taken by another club. And then we prepare accordingly. And that's what any sensible business should do. And it's no different in football.
But I mean, when you cast your mind back to that sunny afternoon in Manchester at the beginning of August, I mean, it seems like a lifetime ago. And it going into the office now must be like a very different place because all the staff have changed.
Well, you know, that's the difference in the football club is there's 350 odd people here that work full time. And if you lose 6, 7, 8 people, actually, the impact is not as significant as you might think. And of course, they're high profile people. So from a public point of view, it is significant. But the key is getting in good people to replace them. And, you know, we're very lucky that we've got a huge depth of talent in the club now that we didn't have even 5 years ago, let alone 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And so when these things happen, the key to it is to be resilient and to be able to, first of all, keep everyone else calm, make sure that the performance of the team doesn't suffer. And then thirdly, make sure that the long-term plan that you have in place moves ahead unaffected. And I'd like to think that here we are a couple of months down the track and nothing's really changed in that sense. We're still on the pathway that we were on. We're playing the type of football that we want to play. We've got a really good head coach and coaching team in. And we've also got our recruitment team that we had 24 hours ago, largely intact. And, you know, all those things are testament to the way Tony has allowed us, or allowed me, I suppose, to build the club and to prepare for these eventualities.
So let's start with what did happen. And I guess probably from the Albion fans' point of view, it all started probably with the sale of Mark Cucurella and the fact that, you know, for the astonishment, I think probably certainly amongst fans of other clubs, neutral clubs, and the figure that and the fee that the Albion managed to get for him, is that then it's along the lines of, well, Chelsea are looking to rebuild their club. So how long was it in between, as far as the Albion are concerned, Tommy Tuchel being asked to leave and Graham Potter being approached? Or did you get a feeling that Chelsea had really done their homework before this was happening?
I think they'd done their homework. I mean, I think if I look back to the summer, and we always review, you know, what could happen during the season ahead of us, I think we probably felt that most of the top six clubs were fairly settled with their head coaches and managers for the season. And if you look at Liverpool with Klopp, City with Guardiola, Arsenal with Arteta, Tottenham with Conte, Chelsea with Tuchel, generally speaking, you know, we felt that there was going to be some consistency. Obviously, Ten Hag was new in at Manchester United. But when you looked at that landscape, you thought, well, you know, Graham Potter's not going to leave for anyone other than those six clubs if any of them were to come in. The only other possible departure destination would have been England. And, you know, that wasn't likely to happen until at least January, and depending on how Gareth's World Cup goes. And, you know, my cynical head, having spent time in the FA, was if Gareth wins the World Cup, he'll go. And if Gareth has a terrible World Cup, he'll go. You know, actually, there's a fair chance that there might be a managerial vacancy in the new year. That's just the cynical side of me. The real side of me thinks that, you know, Gareth will see out his contract. But either way, you have to think about every possibility. What we didn't expect to happen, obviously, is for Chelsea's new owners to decide that Thomas Tuchel wasn't for them, and there to suddenly be a gap there. And when that happened, you know, literally within minutes of Tuchel being told, Todd Boehly called me and asked about Graham. So, you know, I guess I was probably the first to know outside of Chelsea Football Club that Tuchel had been dismissed. And it was certainly before it was public knowledge. So, you know, in that situation, you see the name come up on your phone and it's early in the morning. You think, this isn't a good call to get early in the morning. It certainly wasn't the alarm call I was expecting. But, you know, these things happen, Al. And unfortunately, in football, there's a very small pool of top coaches and a very small pool of clubs that they like to go to. When one of those clubs has a vacancy, then all of a sudden you know that you've got a very good person, a very good coach, and you're going to be vulnerable.
Now, I mean, one of the issues there with Graham going to Chelsea was the fact that he left with more than he came with. And the fact that, you know, the fact that he's taken arguably the best goalkeeping coach in Europe, if not the world, with him, and the fact that he's taken a club legend who is revered here with him. It kind of, that's, I think, if he'd just gone with the three that he came with and with Kyle as well, I don't think people would be as upset about it. But the fact that he's taken a root and branch approach and Chelsea keep coming back, it's frustrating. It's almost as if Boehly's looked up the definition of world-run club in the dictionary, seen a picture of Brighton and said, I want that.
I totally understand the fans' frustration and the emotion, certainly around the matches and or the match, if you like. I think we also have to have a slightly wider perspective, though. If you look at, you know, Bruno, Ben, Paul Winstanley, between them, they gave our club 25 years service. And I don't know when loyalty kind of starts and ends, but I would say that 25 years service is a pretty good stint in any organisation across three people. And, you know, sometimes I think on the outside, people look at football as being different to any other career or any other industry where people want to progress. They want to provide, you know, a better financial situation for themselves and their families. They want to play or perform or operate at the highest level that they can, in this case, the Champions League. And so I think inside football, inside this club as well, that we're a little bit more or less emotional, a little bit more, you know, unsurprised at the movement. And, you know, we have to become detached from it. And I personally would be a huge hypocrite if I criticised Bruno or Ben or Paul for leaving. I've done it several times in my 26 years in football. And I've done it every time because the community I was moving to was better. And it was better for my family and it was better for my bank balance. And I think people just have to be a little bit more realistic about that. And I get the emotion, totally get it. And it feels, obviously, when a player's gone and a series of coaches have gone and then head of recruitment's gone, all gone to the same club, I totally get that it feels a little bit one-sided. But then again, we've had Lamptey from Chelsea. We've got Colwell from Chelsea. We've got Gilmore from Chelsea. Who knows what other players in the future we might take from Chelsea. And you know, these things happen in football. Sometimes there's a pattern. Southampton sold a lot of players to Liverpool over a short period of time. And they haven't sold a player to Liverpool or lost a member of staff to Liverpool for quite a long time now. So these things happen. It's not something we get emotional about. It's not something that we panic about. We don't feel raided. We don't feel bullied. Quite the opposite. You know, we've ensured that we've got very, very, very significant compensation for all of those people. And we've also ensured that we've had someone behind them who could very quickly step into their shoes, and you'll see virtually no change the way we operate. And on the recruitment front, the same is true. Paul was good, did a good job for us for 8 years, but we've also got a very big team in that area, and his loss will be absorbed very quickly.
But the thing is, the thing is, Paul, I mean, losing personnel is one thing. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, in any other profession and walk of life, man gets offered job with better money and foreign travel is always going to be an enticing thing. And in fact, actually, hopefully next year we'll be able to offer foreign travel as well. But that's another story. But I mean, one of the thing, losing the personnel is one thing. But I mean, what is in place to protect the data that Paul Winstanley and Kyle McCauley had access to? Because, and obviously, there is the worry that, you know, we've arguably got the best squad of players we've ever had. Graham Potter knows all about those players, and we don't want to be raided again in January.
Yeah, the data's totally protected. They don't have access to our main databases on a free-for-all basis. You know, they get access to data for specific players that we're looking at. And largely speaking, Chelsea will be fishing in a different pond to us at certain different levels of the market. So we have no concerns whatsoever about that. Obviously, when it comes to young players, there's always the risk that knowledge is transferred, but not data. And in any case, to be perfectly honest, probably the world's top 100 young players are known to many, many different clubs. Mm. And what people won't necessarily know is the key attributes of those players broken down from a statistical or data point of view by the type of systems that we use. That's the uniqueness. The individuals are not unique. The data itself is not unique. It's how we interpret it that's unique. And that is something that can't be moved and isn't moved and hasn't been moved and will never be moved. So from that point of view, you know, we hope to continue to unearth the Cucurellas and the Cachedos, and the type of players that you're seeing coming in, like Enciso and Sarmiento and Buonatti coming in. All of these sorts of players have not been unearthed just by a human being. They've been unearthed by a series of systems that we use to recruit the best young talent that we can.
Okay. Given that, I know, now this show doesn't normally sort of chit-chat about transfer rumours, because obviously we find that probably 90%, 95% of transfer rumours do come out of the rear end of a cow. But and given that the club has this kind of policy of, if an offer comes, we won't stand in your way. If we have designs on being, on challenging and being a top 10 club or even a top six club, now I do appreciate that those big six do have far more resources than this club. Is it possibly time to revisit the policy of what in other words would sound like a come and get me attitude of, we won't stand in your way, rather than standing firm and saying, actually, yeah, you might have hit the fee that we would consider is appropriate, but we're not in a position to replace them. So clear off.
We've done that many times. And you know, to be honest, it's a nonsense for anyone to suggest that we're an open house, either on players or staff. We have a way of working where we know the value of people. We protect ourselves with contracts. We always look to maximise value on the contracts. And there are always times when we say no. And, you know, that's happened previously. I won't go into details with players, but it has happened. And the problem is, you know, half of those will never become public. And the other half ultimately become public when we do eventually agree to the transfer and we get the price that we want. So it's not open house. Staff members are not prisoners at a football club. You know, you can protect through notice periods, you can protect through gardening leave, but ultimately, legally, you can't say to someone you can't move to Chelsea or whoever else. When it comes to players, again, we can only protect by contract and value of transfer fee. But what you never want in a football club is an unhappy player or an unhappy staff member. There are times when a player is unhappy for a short period, the transfer window closes, they have to get back down to their job, and that's what we pay them to do and that's what we'd expect them to do. But equally, you don't want to have that situation too many times or too many players in that situation at any one time. So you have to be pragmatic and you have to judge when the right time is to sell. And sometimes that might be a little bit earlier than we would all like as fans, but from a business point of view, it might be the optimum time. Mm. And our business model will always be to try and make sure we maximise the value on our investments. And we make a lot of investments in young players. We believe in our coaches to develop them and make them better. And there will always be a point at which we either move them into our first team group and therefore we've saved ourselves a big, very big transfer fee, or we move them out of the club for a big transfer fee, which enables us then to continue the cycle we've created. And that's a very important way of us operating and competing. It's why we're able to be top 10 in the Premier League at the moment and last season, and hopefully into the future, because we have to compete in a different way to the traditional top six, top seven clubs who have much bigger resources, much bigger budgets. They can buy at different levels of the market. They can actually pay the kind of salaries that keep players at the club for longer. And what we're not going to do is we're not going to bust our wage structure just to be able to keep a player for another year. It doesn't make any sense, because unfortunately, if you do that, what you actually do is you bust your wage structure completely. You don't just have one or two players on the highest possible wages. You have 10, 12, 14, 15. And then suddenly that's how clubs start getting into the kind of difficulties that you read about and hear about far too often.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's really good, because I mean, I've really enjoyed watching Mark Cucurella play for Man City this season. It's been great. But
that's a good example of where, you know, where we can say no, and no for lots of reasons. You know, no because at that moment the timing wasn't right. No because the price wasn't right. No because for us to optimise the price, we usually need more than one bidder, and therefore we're not going to give in to the first bid that comes along. But again, you know, you get to a point where the price is actually at a level that you think, actually, this is optimal for the football club and for the football club's wider interests. And, you know, Tony and I, ultimately Tony, because it's his money, have to take a view. And on the receiving end of those negotiations, I'm always in a position where I know what Tony's expectations are. So I can go into a negotiation knowing what my parameters are and knowing when I can say yes, when I can say no, what I need to get. Can I get a bit more? Can I make it better for the football club? And if I can, then I'm quite happy to be the awkward bugger in the room to actually say no. And that's my job. And that's what I'll do whenever it's appropriate for the club.
Well, still on transfers then in that case, given the nature of the timing of the changing of the management, obviously with January we've got coming up, and it'll be Roberto De Zerbi's first transfer window in this country and at this club. Now, obviously, you're not going to give away too much, so I'm not going to ask, but how do you see January panning out? Is there a kind of a flavour as to what's on the club's thinking here?
Well, we've already got Jan Giannotti coming into the club. That's exciting, and he's an exciting talent, and one that we believe has the ability to become part of the group, you know, very quickly. In terms of the rest of the squad, we think we're in a good place. We've got a lot of good cover in good positions. As we've said all along, we want to score goals from all areas of the pitch. You know, we're not hung up as some of the media and a small group of the fans are on a number nine. You know, no one really understands what a number nine is anymore, because most clubs don't play with a number nine. There's one or two obvious exceptions. So from our point of view, we'll always look to strengthen from a position of strength. We won't do silly things. January is never a good time to be in the market for any type of player, because the prices tend to be higher, the options tend to be smaller, and you're not going to get good value. So certainly from our point of view, we don't expect it to be in any way a busy window. We're very happy with the squad we've got, but where we can strengthen, where it's possible, where it's good value to, where it's pragmatic to, then obviously we'll have our options. But we're not expecting to do too much, Al.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to talk about the World Cup shortly, but obviously with this Winter World Cup, we've got eight players representing their countries over in Qatar. You know, is there a worry that someone, say, for instance, like Alexis McAllister, who's playing for one of the teams who could go deep into the tournament, that he will attract interest in January? And again, Moises Caicedo, I'm not sure how far Ecuador are going to progress in the competition. But I mean, these are players that are certainly going to be on people's radars.
Yeah, good people will always attract attention and interest, whether they're on the field or off the field. And we've seen that probably better than any other club in the last 12 weeks. So in a way, it's a big compliment to the club, both on and off the field, how much interest there is in our people. it's obviously frustrating at times because you don't want to lose a head coach and a coaching team 6 games into the season. But we're in a situation where, you know, going to the World Cup, I think we've got the 6th highest number of players from a Premier League club at the World Cup. I think 8 players, and only sort of Arsenal, Spurs, Chelsea, Man United and Man City have got more players going to the World Cup. That's incredible. I think actually we've got more players going to this World Cup than any other World Cup in history combined for Brighton. That's incredible. Incredible.
It is amazing. It is amazing.
So yes, of course, we're going to have more attention on us, or as much attention on us as the bigger clubs and on our players. And, you know, part of me wants them obviously to do really, really well. The other part of me hopes that they have a quiet World Cup and get on with the rest of the season. But yeah, that's me being selfish.
Okay. Well, we're going to move on to the appointment of Roberto De Zerbi very shortly. But before we do that, I do just want to talk about one player that could have been subject to some transfer rumours but in the future. But sadly, that will no longer be. And that's Enoch Mwepu, who we've had him on the show. He's such a lovely guy. So we're absolutely devastated for him. I mean, just can you just give us a flavour of where he's at the moment?
Yeah, well, first of all, he is an absolutely lovely guy, and what has happened to Enoch is absolutely tragic. You know, this was a player moving into the prime of his career. We felt the best was yet to come from Enoch in terms of playing Premier League football for us. 24 years of age, a fantastic midfielder, a goal scorer. Someone who we genuinely felt was going to be with us for some time, and actually had the potential, ironically, we think, to go on to even bigger things. And from that point of view, we're devastated for him and for his family. He has dealt with the terrible blow that he's received with incredible dignity and resolve. He's got strong faith. That's helped him, I'm absolutely sure about that. And we're currently talking to Enoch about what options there might be for him to stay with us in a different capacity. And, you know, I sincerely hope that we're able to find a way to do that. It's not easy these days because of the work permit situation and GBE situation, even for non-players. But we love him here. He's such a popular figure around the club. And we're hoping that we can find a way to keep him here in some capacity.
Al?
Great, great stuff. I mean, obviously, all fans, you know, and it's kind of interesting to see so many football fans across the world sort of wishing him all the best, especially when the news came out and in the kind of the manner it did. You know, it was a shock to us all. So just repeating Paul's message, you know, good luck to Enoch. And like I say, if he can stick around to be part of this amazing sort of progressing project, then, you know, good luck to him. Let's get back to a subject that we were discussing just now, the World Cup. A, in the middle of a season, B, in a non-footballing place, where C, and let's not get too political here, it can be unpleasant for certain aspects of society. Does the club, either you personally or the club as a line, have an opinion on this particular tournament?
I think, you know, staying away from the politics, it's certainly not my job to talk politics, but I think we're all uncomfortable with it for lots of different reasons. I think coming at the time it does at this stage of the season is obviously a problem for us, for clubs generally, for football leagues around the world generally. Where it is, why it's there, how it's got there, all those sorts of things are complex and equally disturbing in different ways. But it's here. And, you know, we've now got to work through this period of the next 6 weeks in a, you know, for us, this is the first time in 26 and a half years working in football that I've ever had a 6 week period in the middle of the winter where I'm not going to be, you know, up and down the motorway, you know, watching Premier League matches. So it's a very strange situation personally and for everyone at the club. And, you know, we're going to be taking the opportunity here to give some of our most of our staff some time off, which they wouldn't normally get because it's a rare opportunity to do that. We've started work on the Tunnel Club, which is a new facility that we're building in the stadium. We're progressing our plans for some of the work we're going to be doing outside the stadium and moving forward with different planning permissions for that. So it's going to be a busy time for us anyway. It's not going to be a big holiday for us, unfortunately, but it is an opportunity to do things at this time of year that we wouldn't be able to do normally. So that's a small positive in what is an uncomfortable situation. Yeah. And certainly none of us are happy about having a World Cup at this time of year, for sure.
Well, I don't think it would be a problem if it was a country that had some sort of like footballing heritage. I mean, one of the people that were bidding for it and for this particular World Cup was Australia, and there's a possibility that could have been a Winter World Cup, but at least that's a country that has a sporting heritage, a football heritage, and is trying to develop its football culture. I mean, that wouldn't be so much of an issue. It's just the fact of where it is, when it is, and the social issues that they have it just feels wrong. And you know, and quite it's rightly, like, a lot of people are boycotting it
on every single level. It just feels wrong. I mean, the only thing that's of passing interest to the likes of you and me, and probably sort of, you know, thousands of people across Sussex, is that the fact that we have eight people, eight players at the World Cup. And so we're kind of going to cast half an eye over them, especially those that are saying, right, not interested in it because it's this, because it's that, because it's the other. But it sounds a bit morbid, but it is like rubbernecking a car crash. You can't not look. And so, you know, obviously we wish our players well, but not too well to the point that they're going to be sort of headhunted, but well enough that you think, you know, hey, look at the quality of players that we've got at our club. And like you say, let's face it, like to you and me, AD, and probably Paul as well. Yeah, it's something we're going to just crack on with our work because, you know, a lot of the games are on during the day. But you're going to sort of like stick your head around the corner and have a look at the screen, see what's happening anyway, aren't you?
I'm saying I'm boycotting it, but I know that
exactly. You can't not, can you?
I know, but I mean, in regards to it, the club issued a statement yesterday in association with Kick It Out. How come only seven clubs actually signed that statement?
I don't know. It's the honest answer to that. I mean, I can only, you know, speak for us when I say that, you know, when it comes to doing the right thing, we try and be on the right side of that. That's not because we're virtue signaling or because we're what, you know, in any way better than anyone else. We're simply trying to make the right, the right point in the right way at the right time. And you know, for me, this World Cup is a strange one for lots of reasons. As I said, uncomfortable for lots of reasons. But you know, you're right. I think the vast majority of people will watch it, even if they feel uncomfortable with it. I feel it's slightly uncomfortable for the players and coaches who are being put on in a difficult position every day, being asked questions about human rights and some of the issues, because unfortunately it wasn't their choice to have this World Cup there at this time. They've simply got to go and do their jobs. I think it's really for the politicians and for, you know, in this case, FIFA, to answer to those sort of questions. And, you know, I feel personally uncomfortable that there might be some members of our community in this city who either stay away from Qatar or won't feel comfortable when they're in Qatar because of their sexuality or because of their own beliefs. And that's an uncomfortable feeling because that's not right. We all know that's not right, but that's our culture. That's our view of the world. And that again makes me feel uncomfortable. And I really hope that at the very least out of this World Cup, the issue of some of those human rights challenges and questions, the profile this World Cup will give them, will actually force some different thinking, and that in a decade's time or a generation's time, we won't have the same fears about people travelling to that part of the world if they happen to be, gay or bisexual or whatever it happens to be. That obviously is something that could come out of this World Cup that's good. Let's see what happens. But as I say, I think we all feel a little uncomfortable about the whole situation.
Right. Coming back home then, in that case, you mentioned it just a couple of minutes ago there, that the building of the Tunnel Club and various bits and pieces that are going on during this sabbatical. So what can we expect to see at the Amex that we currently can't at the moment by the time we return on, what is it, New Year's Eve?
You won't be able to see anything, actually, because all of the work that's being done is sort of behind-the-scenes work. And as I look out of the window here at the moment, there's a line of big trucks looking to take away a whole load of concrete from underneath the tunnel area of the club, where we're burrowing down to create a new facility, which is going to be pretty exciting. I think only Manchester City and Tottenham have got one in this country. And it will be a great immersive experiential hospitality facility for people to enjoy at the Amex, which, you know, which we haven't been able to previously provide. So all of the preparation work's going on for that. Doesn't take away any general admission seats. It's additive to the size of the stadium in that sense, albeit in a small way. And then we're looking to move ahead with improving the external areas of the stadium. So moving ahead with some of the planning for the fan zone ideas that we have, we want to make sure that we improve what's known as the wayfinding at the stadium. So how to get around the stadium, the look and feel of the signage. We want to albinize the stadium a bit more. I think we've got a lot of grey concrete mass here, which isn't particularly attractive. And 11, 12 years into the stadium's life, we feel we're due an upgrade in terms of how we look and how we present ourselves to the outside world. So some of that work will start in terms of preparation, and that will continue into next summer and also into the summer after. You know, this is a big project. It's a bit like painting the fourth bridge. It doesn't happen overnight. By the time you do start it, you know, and finish it, you've got to start it again. So, yep. You know, a lot of work going on. And I think people over the next 18 months or so will see quite a significant transformation.
Does this mean having a blue roof back?
Well, the roof is something I want to look at from a point of view of sustainability and see if we can add some solar panels to the roof to start generating more of our own energy, to start to try and neutralize our carbon footprint more than we do. But again, that's a big investment that requires a lot of planning, a lot of thought. And, you know, in an ideal scenario, I'd have blue solar panels that stretch across the entire roof. We'd have a blue roof. We'd generate some of our own energy. We'd offset our carbon footprint. We'd have a better looking stadium. Everyone would be happy.
Yeah.
And tell
is there any plans to improve the actual the concourses as well? I mean, it's just become, I mean, West Upper, for instance, it's just...
You've got to remember is that when we went to the West Upper concourses during lockdown, and we said we had the privilege of the
yes, there's nobody there, and it looked tiny.
Well, there's that. I mean, when the place is empty, it was grey and abandoned, and you know it looked horrible. And even when it's empty, you think, or especially when it's empty, you think, my God, this place looks grim.
But that wasn't my question.
You fancy tarting up that concourse
The internal areas of the stadium will be a second phase of the project. I mean, I think once you get into the stadium, most people's eyes are fixed on the grass, and so they should be. That's where the action takes place. That's where the drama is. That's where the theatre is. But that means that we also still want to make sure that the experience prior to that and after that is as good as it can be.
Yeah.
I think, you know, again, a lot of things I've heard here over the decade that I've been here have been about, you know, we've got friends and family that sit in different parts of the stadium. We can never actually connect with them to get a drink and something to eat either before or after in a comfortable environment. I want to try and change that. I don't think we're ever going to be able to build lounges big enough for people to mix in. And it's not the way the stadium model was built, but we can create better equipped outdoor areas where kids are welcome, where different generations of families and friends can meet. Regardless of where they sit in the stadium, and they can get better food, better drink, access to toilets under cover. They are the sort of plans that we're looking at. And some of the stuff that has gone through planning already is way wide of what we want to do. They were experiential just to try and see, you know, what appetite was out there for the sorts of things that we want to do. But in terms of how it will look and feel in reality, those plans are a long, long way from what we want to achieve.
Yeah. Sure, I mean, the question I was actually asking was, I mean, in terms of, I mean, if you look at it, like, I'm going to use the West Up Stand Upper as a prime example. You've got the biggest stand with the most attended, with the most number of seats in the stadium and the least amount of concessions.
Yeah. Again, it's a mix, AD, of trying to make sure that you've got space for people to move around rather than creating more queues, which then limit the ability for people to move around. So as with all these things, it's a balance between facilities and safety and movement, frankly. Mm. And the top of the West Stand is actually, you know, ironically, in the biggest stand, one of the narrowest spaces that we have to work with. By definition of the design of the stadium, it actually is probably a very tight space up there.
Mm.
But yes, I hope the combination of uplifting the look and feel of the stadium, creating more facilities outside will then take the pressure off of some of the facilities inside, which in turn gives everyone a better experience, whether they want to be outside or inside before or after the game. But yeah, I think, you know, we're very committed to doing that. The fan experience, which sometimes gets mocked, is actually very important. It's not just about what happens on the pitch. It's about the whole day. And one thing we can't control, and I know that people think we can, but we can't, is the transport to and from the stadium. That's part of the experience that is outside of our control. But when we get people here, we want them to have a great time, regardless of the result. Result's always going to be the most important thing. It's always going to be the reason for people to come. But at the same time, we hope people enjoy some good food and drink, some good chat, some good sort of mixing with their friends and family. And we want to make that experience as good as it can be.
Talking of food and drink, what's your personal opinion? And again, does the club have a policy on this, of the law changing to allow people to be able to drink a beer in their seats?
I've got one view, and the head of safety and security here has another. You know, I've long felt that not being able to have a beer while watching the game is a nonsense. And, you know, I can do it at cricket, I can do it at rugby, I can do it pretty much everywhere apart from at football. And that's because of a fairly archaic law that basically says football fans don't know how to behave and will misbehave if they're allowed to have a beer. I personally would like it changed. I don't like the idea of people having 3, 4, 5 pints in a rush in order to drink before they get to see the game, because that doesn't help behaviour, in my opinion. But equally, we also know that some people like to throw their beer when a good thing happens or we score a goal.
Not at these prices, Paul. Not at these prices.
But you know what? Unfortunately, that kind of behaviour doesn't help my argument. And it actually reinforces the argument of the health and safety authorities, who say, well, you know what, there are people that don't want to be drenched in beer, that, you know, they're going out afterwards, they're doing other things, you know, that's not acceptable, and how are you going to deal with that? And it's difficult to answer that, because, you know, we've all seen it. You know, it's fun in the moment, but afterwards everyone thinks, shit, I'm sticky, I'm smelly, I don't really want to be in a situation where that can happen. So, you know, if it were to ever happen, there would have to be, you know, a change in people's behaviour in that regard. And you know, it's difficult because you'll always have some, unfortunately, that will spoil it for others. But my own personal view is it's certainly something that should at least be trialled. And if people don't behave appropriately, or if it does cause a degeneration in behaviour, then obviously we'd have to go back. But I'm not alone in that thinking, but I think we'd have a lot of work to do to convince the health and safety authorities that it was a good idea.
Okay. Well, I mean, we've got to move on to actually getting into the stadium, Paul. And there's been a change in regards to certain issues in regards to away tickets. It's not been popular. It's been controversial. And some have said it's just not right, for want of a better phrase. So, I mean, why was the change put in place, and what can we do to improve it?
Well, I mean, first of all, this has been something that's been monitored by supporter services team and the security team over the last sort of couple of seasons. It doesn't come from me or the board. It comes from the operational staff that have to manage it. And there's two issues, really. First of all, we were seeing an increasing pattern of behaviour, bad behaviour, at our away games. Small but not insignificant groups of people behaving in a way that significantly impacted on the experience of other Brighton fans at games. The number of complaints about that behaviour were literally going through the roof. We tried to understand why it was happening, where it was happening, and we started to realise there was a pattern of those that were being ejected and sometimes arrested were often people that weren't the people that were supposed to have the tickets in the first place. So that led us to think, well, OK, so what's happening here? Why are these people attending games? How are they getting the tickets? We then realised that there were a number of people who were buying tickets for away games regardless of their intention to attend the match. They were either then passing those tickets on, they were selling those tickets on, and both of those things were in contravention of terms and conditions and also the law. And there was a correlation between the number of people holding tickets that they shouldn't have had and the bad behaviour. So that was the first issue. The second issue was an increasing number of complaints from people who were in the tier that were just missing out on access to away tickets for the most popular games, saying that they were aware that there were a lot of people going to those games who didn't have the required loyalty points and yet were still getting tickets. How could this happen? This isn't fair. What's the club doing about it? So as with all stories, there's two sides. There's the version of events that some people might want to believe because they're the ones that are being disadvantaged by a new policy. There's a different version from those people that are missing out because of an abuse of a policy. So two things happened. Supporter Services decided to hold back a certain number of tickets per match for collection, and only were those tickets were released on production of the right ID. And then a series of random checks once the names had been written on tickets, just to actually make sure that we were doing as much as we could to protect the interests of all Brighton fans. What actually happened is the number of non-collections of tickets is way above the typical no-show rate for an away game, way above. And equally, the number of ticket checks, the random checks, are actually showing people having those tickets they shouldn't have. So give an example. At Wolves, there were 15 ID checks and 7 people were unable to produce ID that matched the name on the ticket. And in 5 of those cases, the name had been removed completely, which is a pretty big clue that the person that's got that ticket shouldn't have had it. On the collections, over 25% of tickets were not collected. And that's against an average no-show rate for that game of around 10 to 12%. So you're seeing a very, very significant increase in the number of people that...
You've got to caveat that, though, Paul, because on both occasions, on both the Man City game and the Wolves game, you would have had people that would have purchased tickets who would have been intending to travel by train, and there was train strikes.
Yeah, but Adi, that doesn't make sense, because the no-show collection was almost double the average no-show in the stadium. So if you take into account that people couldn't get there by train or couldn't get there by transport means... What it doesn't account for is why those that were being asked to collect tickets were in proportion more than double or almost double those that couldn't attend right the way across the board. So don't forget, we're getting statistics from Manchester City that show us how many people are going through the turnstiles in total versus the percentages of people that we're asking to collect tickets. And that's actually been the case for every game so far where we've had ticket collections and random ticket checks. The proportion of no-show collections versus the no-shows generally has been almost double, and the numbers of people being asked to produce ID on a random collection has in almost every case been 50% unable to do so. So that shows you the extent of the issue, and that shows you why we were getting a higher level of complaints from people who claimed they were missing out on tickets that didn't have the loyalty points. On top of that, since those processes have been put in place, the number of people ejected and arrested has come down significantly. So again, these are early days for the checks, but unfortunately what it does show is that there was a problem. And actually, as far as the supporter services team are concerned, it's possibly an even bigger problem than we thought it was. So the checks will continue into the second part of the season, and they'll be maintained for as long as we feel that there's a problem. And this isn't about, you know, being draconian. This is actually about trying to be fair to everyone. Fair to the fans that are missing out. Fair to the fans that are there and don't want to be surrounded by people behaving stupidly. Fair to the club that are hosting us because they're sick and tired of the behaviour of a small group of our fans. And fair to the club because we don't want the reputation for our travelling fans being a problem. So we have to maintain some degree of order. And by the way, we're not the only club that have suffered this issue, and we're not the only club that put in place these sort of checks for the same sorts of reasons. Way back at in my time at the FA, we did this for England games 25 years ago. You know, this isn't a new process or policy. And if you look at it in context, you know, it typically affects around 2% or 3% of fans per game. So it's not a massive inconvenience. It is an inconvenience for those people that have to collect a ticket and would rather not, but most people are compliant. Most people are reasonable. Most people understand. Most people are courteous. Unfortunately, there is a tiny few that are not. And you know, there's quite a few that realise that actually they can't pick the ticket up because they're not the person who's supposed to be having the ticket in the first place. That, I'm afraid, is evident.
Can I put it to you in that case that I feel that on a certain level, the acquisition of loyalty points, which is obviously the issue that we're talking about, well, the root of the issue we're talking about,
here,
in other words,
the next
tier down is missing out, is the acquisition of loyalty points is in itself slightly flawed, in as much as you can only really get them for, certainly you get your bigger numbers when you go buy an away ticket, and you certainly get a certain amount for a home match. And that's it. So that's why people kind of like to push into the queue for an away match. Would it not be therefore prudent to have a look at, are there other ways of actually gaining and acquiring loyalty points, i.e. if you can get to an under 23 match, if you can get to a women's match, even if you spend money in the club shop, whatever it might be, it's the kind of the equivalent of your old Green Shield stamps, that in that way that there are other ways that more loyal fans who support other aspects of the club can also then get to away games. I was just wondering if there's been any thoughts along those lines.
Yeah, it's a good point, Al. Very good point. I mean, first of all, the loyalty point system was designed by Tony himself. So it's a very carefully weighted and carefully balanced system based on the views of a mathematician. So, you know, it's not something that we change lightly, partly because Tony designed it, partly because we know how much thought and effort went into it. And I get lots of emails about, well, why are they doing 10 points for that and 5 for that and 15 for that? There's a reason behind every one of those points decisions. They're not random. They're not sort of, you know, decided on a whim. We don't stick our finger in the air. They're designed on lots of factors, you know, whether it's the attractiveness of the game, the availability of tickets, the travel, the likely travel issues, the time of year, where we are in the league, who the opposition is, where they are in the league. There's a whole bunch of sort of factors that go into deciding what the points should be for any given game. That's the first point. The second point is, you know, looking at it more widely and seeing if we can extend it is not a terrible idea, but it's something that Tony has always shied away from because he feels that the system is really designed around first team matches and first team men's matches at that. So it's something we do keep under review. But as I say, we don't change the system lightly. And unfortunately, I think one of the other challenges is that for some fans, and I actually had this email in yesterday saying exactly this, that the fixed price for an away ticket has made an away ticket disposable for some people. They're quite happy to waste, if you like, £30 in order to collect the points that keep them in the top tier. I find that really disturbing because, you know, the whole point of fixing the price for an away ticket is to actually protect fans and to give them the best possible chance of having a reasonable day out of football with a minimum amount of cost involved. But if some people are starting to abuse it because it's so cheap, in their words, that concerns me. That's a worry because it might be cheap for someone, but it certainly isn't cheap for somebody else. And that's a worry for us.
But I mean,
I think the bigger picture is that the tickets must still be capped at 30. And I know the FSA specifically wants it at 20. But I do take the point. But I mean, that's kind of using a sledgehammer to crack a nut attitude, isn't it?
Well, it's not my attitude. It's a fellow fan that's actually written in and suggested that. And that's a worry, as I say, because if people genuinely think a ticket is disposable because it's only, quotes, £30, then we might have a bigger problem than we thought. And I know, as I said, other clubs have had this issue where their own systems have been cannibalized or harvested, whatever the word is you want to use, for people, you know, to maintain their own status. And the trouble is, I think we've actually seen that because we haven't in the past acted on our own threats to look more closely at this, people thought, well, they're not serious. Now we are being serious. You know, there's a small group of people that don't like it, and that's unfortunate, but they tend to be the people that are abusing the system.
But what about the people that aren't abusing the system? I mean, is there, I know stories that basically sounds like they've become collateral damage to it.
Well, I think that's a bit unfair. We're talking about a very small number of checks per game. So a very, very small number of people are being inconvenienced per game. But the numbers show that we're right to do that. And what we're beginning to see is people in the lower tiers having a little bit more confidence in the system that they may be able to get a ticket and use it in a way that they haven't before. But like anything, you know, when people abuse a system, even if it's a small number, the large majority of people suffer some inconvenience. It happens at airports. You know, I quite like to take a bottle of water onto a plane with me, but I can't get it through security, so I have to dump it in the bin before I go through. I'm not a terrorist. I'm not going to do anything stupid with that water, but I'm inconvenienced as part of the vast majority of the public that are. You know, there are so many situations in life like that where the actions of a small number of people inconsiderately are affecting the way other people go about their lives. And it's unfortunate, but I don't think that a small number of people being asked to show ID or to collect their ticket to every match in order to protect the greater majority is a big deal. And as I say, it's interesting, as this process has gone on and as we've been public with the figures and why we're doing it, more and more emails coming in saying, I support it, actually. I hated it at first. I thought it was completely over the top, sledgehammer to crack a nut type language. Now I see why you're doing it. Now I get it. Oh, and by the way, the last two away games, my experience has been a lot better because some of the idiots aren't there. And that actually is a positive thing for us, not a negative.
Yeah.
So, sorry, with that in mind then, and given what I'd asked about sort of other methods of acquiring loyalty points, do you believe that, assuming that you can get to the bottom of this issue, you feel you won't necessarily need to look at that?
Well, I personally would like to sort of keep sort of that on the agenda, because I think it's a good idea. And I like the idea of helping to boost attendances for the women's games. Obviously, under 23, under 21 games are a little bit more difficult, because unless we're playing in the EFL Trophy or Papa John's or whatever, we can't fit that many people into the training ground. So what I don't want to do is try and solve one problem and create another, because demand exceeds supply for those games as well, although it's a nice problem to have. But I think that the vast majority of our fans are fantastic people that just simply use the system in the way it was intended. Unfortunately, there's a tiny minority that, for whatever reason, feel that it's okay to use terms and conditions as an option. And unfortunately, there's a few people amongst those that then behave like idiots when they get into the ground and lead to all kinds of problems that we then have to pick up. And what we don't want is our club that we've carefully, very, very carefully and deliberately developed over the last decade, particularly since we moved to the Amex, but 100 years before that, as a good club with good people, good fans, don't cause problems, to start getting a reputation that is different to that. Because unfortunately, talking about impact on everyone else, AD, that's when it will start to have a big impact on everyone else, because the way we're treated, our fans are treated at away games, will significantly change if we don't get a grip of some of the problems we've had in the last 6 to 12 months.
Okay. Talking of watching the women and watching the under 23s, has the is the club any closer to bringing them closer to home yet? Stadium B or Facility B been looked at any closer yet?
Not yet. We're certainly looking at different options. It's a real conundrum, because I don't, you know, Crawley have been great, and they're, you know, they've been really, really good to us. In no way is this intended to be a criticism of them, but it's a long way from Brighton, relatively speaking. It's a red stadium, not a blue stadium. It's not our stadium. We can't control it. And, you know, from that point of view, it isn't the ideal home for a Brighton Hove Albion team of any kind. On the other side of that coin, we have to meet Women's Super League regulations. There isn't another stadium in Sussex that does outside of the Amex. And therein lies an issue. Why can't we use the Amex for every game? Well, the issue there is cost. And, you know, there is a sort of a theory that, you know, we build it and they will come. Unfortunately, with the women's game, internationals and Euros aside, we haven't yet got that level of demand that actually gives us a good enough reason to open the Amex for every game, as much as it would be nice to do so. And what we don't want to do, we don't want to compound the losses that we suffer in women's football already by doing something that is just not right for the game at this stage of its development. I would love to see, you know, a 10, 15,000 attendance for our women's games, and then I'd open the main stadium, the Amex, all the time, because we would be able to justify it, even if we only broke even. But we are such a long way from breaking even on women's games at the Amex, with one or two exceptions. So we've got to find something in the middle. And finding something in the middle is difficult, because it would require a really, really substantial investment from Tony, way above anything that anyone else has ever done in the country, with the exception of Manchester City, who have their mini stadium at their training ground and in between their stadium. Nobody else in the country has done that. And unfortunately, the number of sort of so-called semi-pro clubs in Sussex are not quite the same as some of the semi-pro clubs in and around London, where Arsenal and Chelsea, particularly, to a lesser extent Tottenham, can benefit from a stadium that is not quite as big as Crawley, is not as big as the Amex, but fits in between with a great quality pitch and you know, the right colour scheme for some as well. So we're not there yet, but it's right top of our agenda. We've just appointed a new managing director for women's football who'll be joining us hopefully before Christmas, if not early New Year. She's got a ton of experience in working in the women's game. She'll join our executive committee. She'll report directly to me. So in terms of the seriousness with which we're taking women's football and the investment we've already made with the training facility particularly, no one should be in any doubt about that. But we just need to find a neat solution for the stadium. Yeah. And we're determined to do so.
Okay. Well, in a related but unrelated note, it was brilliant to see in the women's game last night. We had one current and two former Brighton women's players representing their country last night. So take note of that, Gareth Southgate.
actually, that's something we haven't really discussed, actually. We've got to come to the end of the show now and we've got to close up here. Is what did the women's Euros being played at the Amex do for the club? I mean, we know what it did for the women, the women's team, obviously, because they won the tournament. But what did it do for the club?
It was fantastic. I think it was another example of where we were able to demonstrate that this stadium and this city, this part of the country, can host major events that are not domestically focused, like club matches in the Premier League. It brought a new audience to us. I think it opened people's eyes to the city, opened people's eyes to the stadium, opened people's eyes to women's football generally. Members of my own family were watching women's football for the first time during that tournament here live, loved it, want to see more of it. So hopefully we've helped grow the audience as well. But I think, again, to the FA, it was a real message that this stadium is very capable of hosting not only international matches, but international events. And the organisation worked brilliantly. These things are never huge money spinners for us, despite what people might think. That's not the reason we're doing it. We certainly don't lose money, but we don't make a lot of money. The reason we're doing it is to once again put the stadium, but also the city, on the map and give reasons for people to come here that might not otherwise have been here. And then from that point of view, it was a huge success and we were really thrilled with it.
OK, well, but before we close up, I mean, we have got to talk about how it's going now. Obviously, we've seen Roberto De Zerbi come in. Is it true that Roberto was the only one actually interviewed?
Yes, 100%. And, you know, Roberto was the number one on our list. Again, as I said before, we don't have a perfect solution to losing every single member of staff, because in some cases we might have an internal candidate that could step up. In other cases, we have to identify an external candidate. And it's not a perfect process, Andy, because you know, you can have a list of perfect external candidates in inverted commas, but they may not be available at the time that you need them. So you have to have a backup plan. With Roberto, he was very much top of our list. We were very fortunate and in sad circumstances that the war in Ukraine led to him being available when we needed him. And when we met him, Tony, myself and David, we got on immediately with him. And there was an immediate connection that we all felt, not just on our side, but his side as well and vice versa. And we went from there and we didn't ever feel the need, given that he was top of our list, to talk to anyone else. As soon as we realised he was the sort of person that we thought he was the sort of coach that we thought he was, that there was that connection between us all, that we really not only could work together but wanted to work together, then it was really a question of the formalities and getting the deal done. And I laughed. I got an email from a fan about a day after we had appointed Roberto, complaining that it was ridiculous that if we had a succession plan, that it wasn't done quicker. it was one of the quickest appointments of a Premier League manager in history from scratch, when we had no warning or planning that it was like to come, only the planning that we could rely on and hope that would work in the situation that we were facing. Six games into the season, but apparently we weren't quick enough off the mark for some. Yeah. But that's life. That's football. But
Did it require much arm twisting?
Not at all, because there was this, as I said, there was this connection. Roberto had done an incredible amount of homework on us. I mean, he literally reeled off all of our players, you know, left foot, right foot, you know, what they were good at, what he felt he could work on, what system he would play, what lineups he could play in certain situations, versatility of players. I mean, I don't think that people were, you know, as surprised as they might have been when he, you know, he played Pascal at right back. You know, he's got an idea and a picture in his head of where every one of our players can play beyond where people think that they can play. And he had that from the moment we met him. And it's only developed and been enhanced since he's been working with the players. Yeah. He's got a great sense of humour. His English has improved immeasurably in a really short space of time. All of the staff he's brought in, who are mainly Italian, one Spanish goalkeeping coach, all speak English to varying degrees, but very, very well for the most part. Crofty has fitted into the group superbly. Roberto insisted on having a club coach and an English club coach as part of his team. We didn't insist on that or impose that. That was his idea. And equally, we've been really pleased with the way Shannon has stepped up to replace Crofty at under 21 level, doing a really good job there with Gary Dicker. And, you know, we've got one or two other appointments that we're in the process of making. Mike Cave's come in as assistant technical director. We've got our new managing director for women's football. We've also got a couple of other academy coaches that I think people will be pleased to see at the club, which we'll announce hopefully over the next few weeks as well. So, you know, once again, making sure that we've got plans in place to replace key people, making sure that where we have them internally, we can find them externally quickly, and because we've identified them, and also constantly backfilling so that we've got real quality and depth throughout the club. Absolutely critical to the way we operate.
Well, OK, well, we're going into the break. We're sitting seventh in the league, still in the League Cup, and eight players going to Qatar. It's an amazing place to finish.
Charlton's going to be a hoot, mate.
Charlton's going to be great. We love going to Charlton. It's brilliant. One of our favourite. Happy hunting grounds, actually.
It is. Brothers in arms.
But it's, you know, I mean, looking forwards, I mean, looking at the progress the club has made, I mean, we had that point where the high point of the Leicester game, and it all kind of like fell very, very flat after that with Graham and all the staff going. But then it was reignited again, and the buzz is back, and the energy and passion that Roberto's showing as well. I mean, I hope there's room in the director's box for him when he gets an inevitable touchline ban. But it's it's a brilliant way forward. But I mean, obviously, we still have to deal with VAR, though, Paul. Still have to deal with VAR.
Yeah, unfortunately, VAR hasn't been our best friend, has it, in recent weeks. But I mean, the energy in the club, frankly, was never lost, even with Graham's departure. I mean, I think the staff here know how we work. They trust us to have a plan. They know that, you know, that the plan will be enacted as quickly as possible once we've confirmed, you know, what we need to do and how we need to do it. So the energy and the sort of the buzz in the club after Leicester wasn't diminished. Totally understand why it would be from fans' point of view on the outside, because they're not experiencing what we experience every day. There is a long-term plan here, and there always has been. And as I've always said, and Tony's always said, there will always be bumps in the road. You know, this is professional sport at the highest level. We're dealing with high-level athletes who are always looking to improve performance. And the irony is, the better we make our players, the better our staff perform, the more likely it is that we're going to lose them at some point. The key to us, and the job, biggest and most important job I have, is to make sure that we have plans in place to deal with that eventuality when it comes. Not if it comes, when it comes. And I think the club's in a good place. We've got a great owner, got really good management, terrific staff, fantastic fans, great facilities. You know, we are where we are because we deserve to be there. What we've got to do is work hard to stay there and improve it even further.
And that is all we've got time for. So, of course, thank you so much to Paul Barber joining us. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been AD Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and, of course, on our podcast and in association with allfootballshirts.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you all again next week. Cheers. Bye.
I love the colourful clothes she wears. she's already working on my brain.
Vibrations are happening.